from WJFF in Jeffersonville. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, COVID surge. Cases are ticking up again as the highly contagious BA2 subvariant spreads rapidly. We chat with Dr. James Cruz, Chief Medical Officer of Wayne Memorial Community Health Centers, for the latest. And the Catskills Food Hub is pausing retail operations. We'll chat with Food Hub board member Mike McLuhan about why they're doing that. And also we'll check in with Close to Home, the podcast from Leif Johansson. He checks in with a past childhood friend and current mountain keeper, Taylor Jaffe. That's all coming up. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. As Russian and Ukrainian troops reposition to the eastern part of Ukraine for an expected new surge in fighting, the damage is becoming more clear in the country's north. NPR's Nathan Rott visited Cherniv, which was recently under siege from Russian troops.
I'm walking on a track surrounding a soccer field in eastern Chernihiv, and in the middle of the field is a giant crater. The stands around the track are destroyed. Local officials told us that one security guard was killed when shelling happened here. 200 people were killed in Chernihiv proper, not including the outlying areas, and at least 500 were injured. They also said 10 to 15% of the city in northern Ukraine is completely destroyed. Nathan Rott, NPR News, Chernihiv.
Ukrainian officials are calling on civilians in the eastern Ukrainian region of Luhansk to flee immediately, warning that the Russian military is moving forces into the region in preparation for an offensive. The BBC's Emma Vardy reporting that shelling in neighboring Donetsk has already increased, endangering the lives of residents who remain.
There's been a renewed sense of urgency for civilians to evacuate from the Donbas region following the attack which killed more than 50 civilians at a railway station in Kramatorsk in Donetsk. The area, along with Luhansk, is expected to become the focus of the war. Ukraine's deputy prime minister has said around 10,000 people have escaped from cities in the south and east through humanitarian corridors over the past 2 days. But just a few of the tens of thousands of people trapped in Mariupol have so far been able to get out. It's hoped the new humanitarian corridors will help others to be rescued.
The BBC's Emma Vardy reporting there from Lviv. The vaccine mandate for federal workers that has been blocked for months by an injunction can start to be enforced after an appeals court ruled in the Biden administration's favor this week. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports that it's not yet clear what that means for workers.
A panel of judges in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals found that the lower court judge who had blocked the vaccine requirement didn't have jurisdiction. They reasoned that if a federal worker has a problem with the vaccine rule, they need to use an internal review process, not sue in federal court. Erin Fusse-Brown teaches law at Georgia State University.
In theory, yes, the federal government, as an employer, could start enforcing the vaccine mandate.
But the people who might be affected are only a very small portion of the workforce. As of December, only 3% of federal workers were still unvaccinated and did not have an approved exemption. And the federal government has not commented on how or whether it will begin enforcing the requirement. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Liam Mayo from the River Reporter. Representative Jonathan Fritz, who represents Wayne County, has introduced a pair of bills in the Pennsylvania legislature targeting the fracking ban in the Delaware River Basin. The first bill would change the balance of power within the body that passed the ban, the Delaware River Basin Commission. It would give Pennsylvania a plurality of votes on the commission rather than the single vote every party gets under the current structure. The other bill would change the commission's compact to ensure that none of its rules interfere with fracking. The Milford Theater will host its first drama production in 20-some years at the end of April, as Death of a Salesman takes to the historic stage. The Milford Theater opened in 1911 as a silent movie house, and after a mid-century heyday, was slated for demolition in the early 1990s. Developer Bill Rosato's Milford Hospitality Group purchased it in 2021. His tenure as the theater's patron got off to a rocky start with the placement of political signs on the property, but is beginning to spring to life following a $1 million-plus renovation. And the Pennsylvania State Senate voted on Tuesday to expand institutional sexual assault to include assaults by caregivers on care-dependent individuals. The legislation, introduced by Wayne and Pike County Senator Lisa Baker, expands upon a current law against sexual assault that applies to institutions such as prisons, schools, and law enforcement. Its expansion looks to recognize the position of power caregivers hold over care-dependent individuals. This news roundup is produced in partnership with The River Reporter. I'm Liam Mayo.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The daily average of new coronavirus cases in the United States ticked up 1% on Friday as BA2, the highly transmissible Omicron subvariant, spread rapidly. That's according to reporting in the New York Times today. It was the first uptick after weeks in which the country was beginning to recover from the Omicron-fueled winter surge. Experts have been warning that another surge was coming since BA2 swept through Europe, where past virus waves have been harbingers of what's to come in the United States. And a number of high-profile coronavirus cases have been reported in recent days, from Attorney General Merrick Garland to Broadway and movie stars. I spoke with Dr. James Cruz, Chief Medical Officer of Wayne Memorial Community Health Centers, about this latest uptick and about the second booster shots they're offering at Wayne Memorial Community Health Centers. We should note Wayne Memorial is a financial supporter of WJFF.
We're offering a second booster dose of the mRNA vaccines, for the Pfizer vaccine or the Moderna vaccine. We're also offering a third dose of the Johnson & Johnson or the Janssen vaccine. It's really a second booster of the mRNA vaccines, which for most people would be their fourth dose. But people that had severe immune suppression, like folks with cancer on chemotherapy or people on high-dose immunosuppressants for organ transplant and stuff like that, were supposed to have a three-dose primary series. So for them, it would actually be their fifth dose because it's the second booster. It is given at least 4 months after the last booster dose. And the CDC basically says people who are age 50 and older, or people who are at higher risk of COVID, such as diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, cancer, things like that, that they may take a second booster shot. It's not necessarily a recommendation, but it's a they may take sort of thing.
Are you recommending it, or what is your position there?
My position on it has been, since case rates are pretty low right now, I'm not really encouraging folks to get that second booster unless they are at particularly high risk, you know, particularly with lung disease, cancer, chemotherapy, or own immune suppressants. I'm really recommending they get it, or someone who's at high risk who's going to be going on a cruise or going to have another high risk exposure situation. I've really been recommending them get it. But for most people, I've kind of recommended holding off to see what the numbers do. If you see a case spike, get it, or maybe wait till the fall to get it when we really anticipate a case spike. However, we are seeing slight uptick in numbers, so we may be at the beginning of another spike. I would certainly keep my eye on that.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that. But first, I guess this has many people wondering, does it mean everyone's going to need an annual COVID-19 shot every year?
We're not sure, but my belief is that's where we'll be going with this. Is it'll be a yearly booster with whatever, you know, and it'll probably change from year to year a little bit based upon what's happened with COVID, how it's mutated, but that we will be looking at regular boosters.
As you mentioned, the second booster is allowed 4 months after the first, which means the current frequency is more than once a year. So would boosters be needed even more than once a year?
We don't know about that. I think once everyone's had COVID, then it'll really probably only need a booster once a year.
And again, probably something we don't know, but all these questions are out there. You have a flu vaccine. Would it make sense to combine the two, a COVID-19 vaccine and a flu vaccine?
One of the companies, I don't remember if it's Moderna or Pfizer, is actually working on coming out with a combined vaccine. So hopefully that's where we will go, is where in the fall you will get your flu and COVID booster every year.
Some folks are divided about the rapid approval of the fourth round of COVID shots with little public debate. Some folks saying that vaccine makers are playing a too big a role in setting the pace. But again, U.S. public health agencies have endorsed that fourth COVID shot. Do you worry about the rapidness of this?
Well, I do a little bit. Not a lot, because we know they're safe. They've really been proven to be quite safe. You'll hear about the complications, but they're really rare, and COVID's very dangerous. So I'm not as much worried about the safety of it. I wonder if it's needed. And I think that's really why they put the May take. And I think it's a discussion with your primary care provider with, are you at higher risk? Do you really need that second booster or not? And I think a lot of factors go into that is, once again, what is your risk of severe outcome if you get COVID? What's your likelihood of being exposed to COVID, and have you already had COVID? I think if you were vaccinated and also had Omicron back in January, you probably don't need this booster.
So you mentioned earlier that COVID cases are rising again. What's driving this uptick, and how much is it up?
Well, there are two things driving the uptick. There is the new Omicron variant, BA2, and it is more contagious than the first Omicron variant, which was more contagious than any variant we've seen. So we've seen an increase in contagiousness of the virus, and at the same time that we've seen really a rapid relaxation of our safety measures, our masking, stuff like that. Now, I'm not necessarily saying we need to go back to masking, but that's what's causing the uptick. However, I'll point out we're still at a much lower case rate than we were a large part of the pandemic. So we've not gotten to real high cases yet, with certainly nothing like the spike that we saw in January and February. But we need to keep our eye on it. It might turn out to be like that.
And are hospitalizations on the rise, or are those fairly steady right now?
Well, they're fairly steady. And I think one of the other things that is going to blunt the spike, even though we've got a more contagious strain, is really a lot of people had Omicron. In January and February, we saw huge numbers of cases, and there were lots of cases that were not diagnosed or not reported. I think one is not everybody got tested, and there were a lot of home tests floating around then. So there are a lot of home test results that do not get reported to the state. So I think the actual numbers are probably much higher than what we saw, and they were incredible.
By now in the pandemic, we kind of know what signs to look for and where to look for them. There were some upticks overseas. There's definitely some upticks in New York City. We've heard about a lot of high-profile government officials in Washington testing positive for COVID-19. What should we do? How cautious should we be?
I think we need to be moderately cautious. I think we did that. Really, a lot of the folks that didn't have immunity to COVID really had it with the Omicron wave that we just had. So I think there is a lot of immunity out there already. Now, I do think we need to be cautious about indoor events. Maybe think about starting back masking if you're going to a crowded indoor event, not necessarily the grocery store, but something more crowded. And I think we really need to keep a close eye on what's happening. I think I saw numbers that New York City saw a 60% increase in the past 2 weeks in their number of cases. Now that's starting from a low point, but a 60% increase is fairly rapid. Washington, D.C. is also seeing a similar increase. And counties in the area, I know in New York, Sullivan County seeing a little uptick, Delaware County is, Pike County here in Pennsylvania is, Susquehanna County. Wayne County hasn't really seen the uptick yet, but it has to be coming with all the surrounding counties seeing it.
So again, let's remind people how to protect themselves. Mask when necessary. I know there aren't those mandates, but it's prudent to do so.
We still mask in meetings now. In healthcare, we're required to mask. We're seeing sick people. They're still masking in healthcare, but we mask when we're in meetings. I think right now, if I was going to a crowded party, I would want to mask for that. But not necessarily mask at the grocery store, because over the whole pandemic, we really haven't seen that much transmission that was traced back to, you went to a grocery store. Most people are fairly far apart and not spending a lot of time close together there.
Let's remind folks again where they can look to get these second boosters if they qualify or have more questions. Where can they go?
Well, now the boosters are really available pretty much anywhere. Most pharmacies, large stores that have pharmacies have it. They can. We're giving them out in some of our offices, usually on certain scheduled days of the week because the demand isn't real high right now. But if they go to WMH.org, the Wayne Memorial Hospital site, and up at the top of the page, there's a banner for COVID vaccine. They can click on that, and that'll give them more information on how to set that up.
Before we go, anything else you want folks to know?
Just, it's not over yet. We do have a little lull, but I would expect to at some point have to put your mask back on again, and certainly would still be cautious about those crowded indoor parties. Try to have things outside, try to keep airflow moving. Try to avoid big gatherings right now until we see how this new spike pans out.
That was Dr. James Cruz, Chief Medical Officer of Wayne Memorial Community Health Centers. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Catskills Food Hub pauses operations. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. I just want to take a moment to express my sincere gratitude to all of you who've supported this station. You literally make public radio happen. So, from all of us here at the Splendid Table, thank you.
You made sure WJFF could stay focused on keeping the community informed and connected. You gave what you could. You made it happen. Thank you for supporting WJFF Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life, we take you to Hungary, where political parties that normally hate each other's guts banded together to try to defeat somebody they saw as a dictator, Prime Minister Viktor Orban. If you picture AOC joining forces with Mitt Romney, you basically get the idea. Behind the scenes, at their Hail Mary pass to save democracy in their country, this week.
Saturday at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Due to funding and staffing challenges, the Catskills Food Hub has paused retail operations this past Monday after several attempts to make the endeavor profitable. According to a statement on their website, the Food Hub will evaluate how to best serve our producers and our community. I spoke to Catskills Food Hub Board President Mark McLuhan about these changes.
The Food Hub was originally conceived to get local food to commercial suppliers like restaurants and the school systems. And during the pandemic, we had to take a sideways step because, of course, all that shut down. So we sidestepped into retail. And it was a great option. It really helped the community. But we've really realized that we really need to get back to our core goals, which is the school systems and the restaurants. And we would love to get back also to retail sales to the people. But we need to get those other two systems functioning much more strongly first.
And so what you're trying to pivot again, and there's a chunk of money that had been allocated and that has now been utilized?
Right. So the Food Hub was initially conceived by the IDA. And, you know, it's really easy to get a steak from the Midwest. But it's really hard to get a steak that's USDA certified from your neighbor. And also the carbon footprint of food is just, you know, expanding. I mean, we pull in stuff from China. We pull in stuff from all over the world now. It's amazing. But meanwhile, we have all these great local producers and we're not utilizing them. So the IDA's concept was that we lower the carbon footprint and we keep it local. And so they funded us in the beginning. Cornell Cooperative Extension has also been a huge partner for us in terms of financing us. And at this point, we've come to the end of that line of financing, and we are seeking new lines right now to keep us running. It was always known from the beginning on paper that this project was going to lose money. And we have spent 5 years proving that fact. So we definitely lose money. We also have proven the fact that the community loves it. It's great for the community. Last year in 2021, we surpassed $500,000 in sales. And to most businesses, you know, that might not be a huge number. But the part of this to really think about is the fact that it was $500,000 spent by local people, and the money went to local people. So we kept all that money extremely localized, and that only helps our community. That only helps Sullivan County.
Yeah, and you've said that the money is being raised here and then going back to the producers right here in the county, but you've also said that dispersing food on a localized level is, oddly enough, very expensive. So why is it so expensive?
It's crazy how expensive it is. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, we easily lose $100,000 to $150,000 a year. You know, the producers are doing well. I mean, they charge what they would probably charge, let's say, at a farmer's market. So, you know, they're very happy, which is great. But by the time you factor in a building, massive amounts of refrigeration and freezer space, so you've got the electrical bill, you've got to heat that building, and cool that building, depending on the season. You've got vehicles, to go and pick up certain products and deliver certain products, not all. Some of the producers do drop off to us, and a lot of our customers do pick up from us. Then you've got salaries. There's an enormous amount of time spent tracking all of the food and then billing the customer for it and paying the producer for it. It's just not a business that's ever going to be running in scale. The reason the ShopRites of the world do so well is because they're operating at a huge scale. They have dozens and dozens of grocery stores. Maybe they'll have two accountants. Well, we have one accountant, and we have literally one little store and $500,000 worth of sales.
And what do you need to be financially self-sustaining to get yourself to that level?
$150,000 a year would work well for us. So one of our core foundations when we set up the Food Hub was to service the school systems. Kids don't know what good food is for the most part. School lunches are not as good as they could be. They're not as healthy as they could be. A carrot for a kid is certainly much better than Doritos. And so it's important, I think, to train kids at a very young age what good food is. So that's one of our goals. The school systems are set up in such a way that to get food injected into their stream is very difficult and expensive. Their budgets are not ones that are strong enough to be able to support good food products. They're more geared towards getting frozen stuff from somewhere else. And so many times we're selling to the schools below cost or even at cost would be nice, but rarely do we do that at a profit. And so that's where a lot of our money goes to basically goes to trying to get the school systems to realize that they need to change.
And what are some possible next steps in order to get the school systems to recognize that and then also to find a way to become sustainable?
Aileen Gunther is working on finding us some funding from the state of New York. She's working very hard for us on that front, and she's not the only one. Also, Mr. Delgado is also involved. One of the other concepts that we're toying with, and we haven't put this into action yet, but we're certainly discussing it. Let's say we've got like a large corporation. I'm going to choose for this example, purely an example, PepsiCo Frito-Lay, which is in Liberty. Let's say that they have 200 employees and they want to make a donation to the Food Hub because we are a 501c3. So we are a tax deductible place where you could hang your money if you so desire and get a tax deduction for it. Let's just say they want to make a tax deduction. They could then utilize that money that they gave us and say, let's say they gave their employees a voucher of, I'm just picking a number, $25. Every week they give every employee a voucher for $25 to spend at the Food Hub. So right now what they've done is they've made a tax, they've made an investment in their workforce and in their community. And they've said, hey, you know what? Be healthy, go out and spend $25 a week on the Food Hub and get great food for yourselves. I think it would be great for employee retention. I think employees would really enjoy that. I think it would also be good when they're going out and trying to get new employees to say, hey, this is one of the benefits that we offer. And meanwhile, the whole thing is tax deductible for them. And that sort of concept could get stamped out across many businesses, perhaps the hospital, perhaps the insurance companies. I mean, you can just start picking out employers and say, is this the way to go? And then what happens is the food hub then sort of becomes a CSA. And then we have a guaranteed base and a guaranteed base of income, as well as a guaranteed base of customers who we're helping to get great food.
You're not shutting down permanently, but are you expecting and optimistic that you'll be getting that funding and finding a benefactor to help?
We're absolutely optimistic that we're going to find the funding we need. I think it's a great cause. There are a number of us on the board and a number of people who aren't even on the board now who we've, let's say, burned out over the years, because those of us that are involved in this have been doing this for, I've been doing this for 5 years. And I know there are other people that are even longer, like Denise Frangiapane, who's with Sullivan Renaissance. She was even on board before me. We really think that it's a great cause, and we believe in it. It's a very active board, very strong board. And yes, literally what we want to do is refocus our attention, get a more consistent funding stream. And then when we come back from this, and in fact, we're not shutting down, by the way, we're still going to continue the inroads that we've made into the school systems. We're still going to continue getting product to the school systems during this month and next month and for as long as we possibly can. We also are going to gear up and really start working towards more restaurants. We're also making delivery runs for some of our producers who don't have the time to do it, so they can spend their time making the food for us, and we're just going to deliver it for them. I would love to see us back online before our harvest season really starts here, which would be June-ish around here. So we're by far not going away. We're just basically resetting ourselves, finding our new source of financing, and really getting back to our core goals.
And how's the feedback been from folks? I know that the last retail dispersion was on Monday. Have folks been generally supportive?
Yes. Sales were actually very high, which tells me that people are going to miss us for this period of a couple weeks, which is just really heartening to see. We've gotten a lot of messages, too, from the producers who they've really come to rely on the food hub for, a chunk of their income. I won't say all of their income, but certainly a chunk of their income. And so they're really going to appreciate us coming back as well, I am sure. But yes, I haven't actually heard anything negative at all. I think people understand that, we are a not-for-profit, and not every not-for-profit always has the kind of funding that they need. And that's a sad thing, but it's a reality.
Where can folks get more information about the Catskills Food Hub?
Sure. You can. We're certainly posting what we're doing on our website at catskillsfoodhub.org. And you could also call the Food Hub if you have specific questions at 845-807-3735.
We've been speaking with Catskills Food Hub Board President Mark McLuhan. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Leif Johansson talks to a childhood friend and now environmental activist about environmental justice in the Catskills. This is Radio Chatskill.
It's been a rough winter one way or another, so putting winter behind us, on the next Wagga Load of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear songs about the spring. Join me, please, for Spring Songs on Sunday afternoon at 3.
I'm Doug Sandberg, host of WJFF's Let's Talk Vets. Thank you for supporting WJFF. Thanks to you, we made our goal. You made sure WJFF could stay focused in keeping community connected and informed. You gave what you could. You made it happen. You stood up for your community radio station. Thank you for supporting WJFF. Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno.
On his WJFF podcast, Close to Home, Leif Johansson takes a deep dive into the institutions in upstate New York that are the foundation of our community, and he explores how they work. In his latest episode, Leif talks to childhood pal and Catskill Mountain Keeper Environmental Justice Coordinator Taylor Jaffe about the history of the environmental justice movement and the steps we can take on the state and local level to promote environmental justice for low-income and minority communities in our region. Here's Close to Home with Leif Johansson.
Hey, welcome back and thanks for tuning in. I want to talk today about environmental justice in our Catskills community. The other day, I got on a call with an old friend of mine, Taylor Jaffe, who I have known since we were both 8 years old and we went to the homestead school together. These days, after graduating from Colgate University, Taylor is working as the Environmental Justice Coordinator with Catskill Mountain Keeper, whose mission is to protect the region's forests and wildlands, safeguard air and water, nurture healthy, equitable, and sustainable communities, empower environmental justice communities, and accelerate the transition to a 100% clean and just energy future in New York State and beyond. So I wanted to get in touch with Taylor to get a better idea of what exactly environmental justice is and how it relates to our communities. And Taylor is an outstanding communicator, so I am going to just go ahead and play most of our conversation without too many edits. But as a heads up, the quality of our video call did get a bit choppy at times, so if you notice any minor audio quality issues, well, come back next week and we will talk about local broadband again. Anyway, let's dive into this. Taylor started off by talking about her long and storied history of working with Catskill Mountain Keeper.
You know, I kind of came to this position because I grew up in Sullivan County in Livingston Manor. My family runs and works Snowdance Farm. So, you know, it's kind of been a long, winding road to get to Mountain Keeper. Back in 2011, when they got really involved in the fracking fight. And Leif, this is fun. This was also when the homestead was kind of getting us involved, too. I was donating some of my profits to Mountain Keeper. So long, winding road to get here, but always kind of been curious about environmental justice and, you know, how we can create better outcomes for our communities. So getting to do this work has been really rewarding.
My understanding of environmental justice, and I want you to jump in and let me know if there's parts of this that I'm missing of it, is essentially that we as a society have a long history of relegating hazardous waste, landfills, things that would impact water supplies negatively to low-income minority communities, and also vice versa, relegating low-income minority communities to areas that are environmentally questionable at best. Is that an appropriate understanding of what the backstory here?
Definitely. That is a really good, good way to kind of describe the backstory. I think when we, you know, when we think about environmental justice, it's really kind of a lens for, you know, looking at both inequality as something that's just descriptive, how things are, and then injustice, which kind of gets more into how things ought to be. And that's really, you know, where we look at how, you know, hazards and benefits are distributed and, you know, disproportionately burdens are distributed amongst communities of color and low-income communities. And then we have to think about, okay, what do we do now? What do we do with this? And you kind of started to get into a little bit of the chicken and egg question, too, that comes up a lot in environmental research. And that is, you know, whether say they'll get cited and then, you know, the property value goes down. So it's, you know, cheaper and low income communities end up there, or, you know, whether we have an already low income and or minority community and then we cite a landfill in their community. So a lot to think about. But ultimately, it really comes down to the fact that we don't want to be citing these burdens with anyone.
That's really interesting the way you put
inequality and injustice. Can you mm-hmm. dive a little bit more into the relationship between those and kind of how they differ?
Sure. Yeah. So just to kind of reiterate, because I know for me, it was something that I, you know, hadn't had to explicitly think about before I really kind of got into all of the literature, but inequality, we can really think of it as just descriptive. So, for example, like throughout the United States, there is an unequal amount of landfills that are sited around low-income communities and communities of color. But then when we get into injustice, it's really looking at the reasons for those sightings. It's how we have to think about how things ought to be and really put that moral lens to it and kind of dig a little bit deeper, think about what we want our outcomes to look like, and then, you know, how we got here in the first place, what systems got us here, and then how we can move forward. So kind of to throw another buzzword in, but also really important for the environmental justice kind of framework, you know, it's this intersection of so many different kind of systems. So intersectionality is it kind of comes from feminist literature, that term coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, and it describes how race, class, gender, and other individual characteristics overlap with one another. So as we're thinking about environmental justice and the justice aspect specifically, you know, there's race, there's class, gender. I think, I don't know all of the statistics off the top of my head, of course, but I think it's something like single mother households are just statistically more likely to be burdened with environmental hazards. So all of these things really just kind of gather together, and they're part of that that how things ought to be side, the justice side of, you know, the environment that we live and work in.
What are some major environmental justice, maybe stories or victories to improve justice for those yeah. impacted by environmental injustices that happened maybe on the national level that we maybe are familiar with and maybe haven't previously associated with the just phrasing environmental justice?
So definitely just the phrasing of environmental justice really kind of came out of a lot of work in the 1970s and the anti-toxics movement. So down south, you know, already dealing with racial injustice, overlapping with the fact that a lot of Black and African American communities specifically were dealing with toxic waste. And that's, you know, from that came the term environmental racism. And from there, we got environmental justice. So that's kind of the start of this framework and this new lens to look at things. And not to say that other communities weren't facing environmental justice hazards before the 1970s, but I think that's really when the big push for this literature and this research came about. And then, you know, one victory on the national level, we've got the, you know, Biden has the Justice 40, and we have the White House Environmental Justice Action Committee, I believe, WEJAC. And just, you know, little things like that, that, you know, as we keep implementing them and as we can keep thinking about environmental justice at this big scale, just benefits everyone in general. You know, I think the first step is just education is really the most important thing here. You know, you can't fight what you don't know. So just kind of adding these pieces and keeping the language in, you know, getting it into common practice and into common knowledge is really important. And then to kind of take it more statewide for New York State, one huge win for environmental justice has been the Climate Leadership and Communities Protection Act. And that got signed into law in 2019. And one really exciting thing for that is they created the Climate Justice Working Group. And the Climate Justice Working Group created a definition for disadvantaged communities under that law. And because of that definition of disadvantaged communities, 35% to 40% of our, you know, kind of climate spending is going to benefit these disadvantaged communities. So long-winded way to say that, you know, the more we can kind of keep this language in common practice, like we can actually get funding after a certain point and move resources to those communities who've been hit first, worst, and hardest.
I know that another big step in New York State has been the passage of the Green Amendment to the Constitution, which was Prop 2 on the November ballot this past year. How is something like that to actually put into our state constitution language that says we all have a right to a clean environment? Have you seen any upshot from that that might be changing the game already? And if not, what are you expecting to see from that?
So that is so exciting. and that was a really, you know, I got to do a little bit of putting up posters and campaigning and that kind of thing for that, which was a lot of fun. And even just in doing that, like around Sullivan County, I focused a lot in like Liberty and Monticello, just because those are more of our urban kind of areas. It was interesting to kind of talk to different shop owners, different people as, you know, I was passing them and, you know, see who kind of knew what I was talking about, who had questions. And overall, like a lot of people were kind of like, what is that for? Which, you know, was awesome to be able to explain, you know, the purpose of the Green Amendment and what it could do for everyone. Since it passed, I haven't myself seen too much upshot of that, but it's really going to come down to how we get it interpreted by our New York courts. So in New York State, I think there's three other states that have some kind of Green Amendment where you're guaranteed a right to a healthy environment. York, we kept our language really broad, which, you know, was pretty purposeful in that. So that way, as it kind of goes through the court system, it can be refined, but we wanted to start really broad. So that way it can have somewhere to go instead of like need to be teased out and picked apart and things like that. So it's been really exciting, and I'm hopeful for what we can do with it.
I also want to talk about some of the work that you're specifically doing with Catskill Mountain Keeper. I know that in a webinar that you gave back in March, you talked about your mapping out of, what was it, PJAs, potential environmental justice areas. Is that right?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what those are and the significance of your work in mapping those out?
Sure. Yeah. So it's been great to be a Catskill Mountain Keeper. And, you know, in kind of coming to this space, Catskill Mountain Keeper has always really been about environmental justice, just because we've been protecting, you know, resources and fighting for communities and doing all of this environmental work that is just people related and people driven, which is really at the heart of environmental justice. But, you know, it wasn't as explicit before. It wasn't explicitly mentioned in our mission statement. And, you know, this is a new position to really just be kind of thinking explicitly about environmental justice in our region. So what I did, I looked at the CATS region in terms of six counties: Delaware, Greene, Otsego, Schoharie, Sullivan, and Ulster counties. And then I kind of got a look at who, so different potential environmental justice areas representing these communities, what environmental hazards and issues by county. And then I mapped that to see where there's overlap between these potential environmental justice areas and these environmental burdens. And, you know, what was really interesting about this, you know, I'd kind of done similar work studying at Colgate University, but to kind of take it more granular at like looking at six counties, it was really interesting to see the data reflected in places that I knew. So, you know, for example, looking at Sullivan County, we have a lot of potential environmental justice areas that are specifically minority areas. So a potential environmental justice area is a census block group that either meets a certain threshold to be a low income community. So it has a low income population equal to or greater than 22.82%. Or it can meet a threshold for being a minority population. So that number differs in urban versus rural areas, just because there's usually a greater number of people of color in urban areas. But, you know, we have a lot in Sullivan County, which, you know, I'm a person of color too. So it was like, oh, wow, like, nice. I didn't know how many people, I just wasn't even seeing myself. So we have a lot of minority communities, a few income, and then a good that are both low income and minority. And, you know, as I was looking for these potential environmental justice areas, it's not necessarily that there's anything bad or wrong happening there, but it's really just, it gives us another lens and layer to try and catch people before they fall through the cracks and before we cite something there. So it's really just, again, it's just bringing this over to these areas and to these communities. So it was very cool to map it out and then overlay those maps with different hazards, just because that, for the most part, hasn't been done, except for really with the new disadvantaged communities criteria that the Climate Justice Working Group has been mapping.
I know that in the findings of your mapping research, you found that Sullivan County has three water systems with health-based violations of, quote, notable concern, I think it was.
Yeah.
All three overlap with 17 different potential environmental justice areas, which is, I think, far more egregious than what you found in other counties in the Catskills region in terms of that level of overlap. Can you talk a little bit more about that finding?
Sure. Yeah. So as I was looking for, you know, different environmental hazards and burdens, water contamination was a big thing to look at. The caveat here is that, you know, I'm only able to look at public water systems just because that's the data that I have. And a lot of people in, you know, we're in rural upstate New York, they have a private well system. So definitely excluding a good chunk of the population. But even looking at these public water systems, you know, I and that notable concern. So for me, the notable concern kind of is about places where it's a water system where the community is really accessing that water a majority of the time, instead of something where it's like a gas station that you're not necessarily going to be coming into contact with that water a lot. So looking at the public water system data, you know, and this is all over the past 10 years. So I don't believe that any of the systems were experiencing notable concern at the time I did the research. But, you know, for anyone who is curious and, you know, I have only time to go back in again and update this as it's a new year, you're able to go onto the EPA Safe Drinking Water Information System, and you could put in a county, you can put in a town, and it'll let you know, how the public water system is doing. But yeah, for Sullivan County, there were three systems of concern. So they had some kind of health-based violation with some kind of contaminant that, you know, could impact human health. And it overlapped with 17 potential environmental justice areas. And those were around Monticello, Liberty, Fallsburg. So also where we see that there's a lot of our minority and minority slash low income populations. I'm pretty sure that the violations have been taken care of, but still, there's still infrastructure questions we can ask ourselves. And also we can dig a little deeper and look at response time to see how long it took to fix those issues. So definitely an interesting finding. And, you know, this research is definitely preliminary in that there's a lot more that we can do to dig deeper.
Were there any other findings in your research that really surprised you or things that you are particularly concerned about?
Yeah. One other thing that I found surprising was that we don't have any state or federal air monitors throughout the Catskill region. I wanted to be able to look at, you know, air pollution data and air quality data, just because that has been, you know, that's a pretty big environmental justice indicator. And especially in Sullivan County, we also have a lot of, you know, higher of asthma than a lot of the surrounding counties. So, you know, I was thinking I might be able to find some information there, but we don't have any air monitors with, you know, publicly available information yet.
What should we be looking out for in the coming months, or maybe just over this year of 2022, in terms of progress that you hope to see in the Catskill region or maybe New York State as a whole in terms of environmental justice?
Well, I think something that's good for everyone to be looking out for is, you know, you could go on to the DEC website, and that's the Department of Environmental Conservation. You can add your email to stay updated and like toggle, you know, your county, toggle the things you're interested in. There's one specifically for environmental justice, and that's just one way to really stay updated and informed. And, you know, in addition to doing that, I think it's exciting, and the more people that can be involved in, you know, there's a comment period right now for the definition of the disadvantaged communities and also for the draft scoping plan that has to do with the Climate Leadership and Communities Protection Act. You know, those are just some ways that the public can make their voices heard as we're, you know, doing so many awesome things that are meant to benefit our communities. You know, it's good to have community inputs that way, you know, all the benefits go where they're supposed to go.
Last question for you. Yeah. Taylor, if you were a benevolent dictator and you had infinite funding, resources, and legislative power at your disposal, what would be some day one changes that you would want to enact to improve the situation for environmental justice in New York or perhaps nationwide or perhaps worldwide?
Oh my gosh, this is the best question. I think for me, I want to get to the root cause. So something that I believe is the root cause to a lot of, you know, having these environmental burdens and harms is the way that we create waste. So I would ban plastic. We wouldn't be making any more plastic. I would want to switch our infrastructure and our electricity grids to renewable sources of energy. And then as much as we can begin recycling and reusing as much of our products and produce and that kind of stuff, I would enact that just because I think having all this excess waste is a pretty big problem. And I think the culture right now that we have around production is a pretty big root cause of, you know, the fact that people do have to get placed next to landfills and other sorts of burdens.
If you ever decide to run for benevolent dictator, you got my vote 100%.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Is there anything else that you want to add? And how can folks learn more about your work and about the work of Catskill Mountain Keeper?
We are, people can look up Catskill Mountain Keeper online. We have, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram as well. Just Catskill Mountain Keeper. And for my work specifically, I would love to offer my email to the community just because, you know, I've got this landscape analysis of environmental justice that's really at a bird's eye view. But in addition to that, it has to be supplemented with lived experience and community knowledge. So I would welcome anyone to reach out to me at Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, at CatskillMountainKeeper.org. And please, I'd love to continue the conversation there.
Well, between New York State's Green Amendment, the implementation of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, and the work that Taylor and the rest of the team with Catskill Mountain Keeper are doing, this is a topic worth keeping an eye on in our region. And of course, as there are more developments, our team at WJFF Radio Catskill will be sure to keep you in the know. Thank you so much to Taylor Jaffe for taking the time to chat about her work with Catskill Mountain Keeper this week. And as always, thank you for listening. I'm Leif Johansson, and this is Close to Home, a podcast from Radio Catskill. Have a great week.
You can hear Leif Johansson's podcast Close to Home at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at WJFFradio.org, check out the other podcasts we have on offer, WJFFradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Tavern on Main Bar and Restaurant in Jeffersonville. Comforting American fare in a cozy neighborhood atmosphere. Menus and takeout orders available online. TavernOnMainNY.com. From the Narrowsburg Union, featuring information about regional attractions and activities, along with products by the region's artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen at Catskills Curated. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
This Week in This American Life, we take you to Hungary, where political parties that normally hate each other's guts banded together to try to defeat somebody they saw as a dictator, Prime Minister Viktor Orban. If you picture AOC joining forces with Mitt Romney, you basically get the idea. Behind the scenes, at their Hail Mary pass to save democracy in their country, this week.
Saturday at 6 on Radio Catskill.
It's been a rough winter, one way or another, so putting winter behind us, on the next Wagon Load of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear songs about the spring. Join me, please, for Spring Songs on Sunday afternoon at 3.
WJFF listeners are amazing. Thanks to you, we've met our goal for our pledge drive. Thank you. You pledged your support for your community radio station. You have our pledge to keep you connected with information you come to rely on. WJFF Radio Catskill, your community radio station.
And thanks to all of our listeners who donated during our Spring Into Action Spring Fund Drive. We met that goal just before 10 o'clock this morning, and we couldn't do it without you. So our genuine, sincere thanks for everyone who donated at WJFFradio.org or called us at 845-482-4141. We do appreciate it, and we do rely on you to provide this listener-supported radio station to the whole community. So thanks so much. Today's forecast for the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania, showers with highs around 50. The showers moving out after midnight, then cloudy, a low around 30. Partly sunny tomorrow and highs in the mid-40s, but warming up to the upper 50s Monday and the upper 60s on Tuesday under partly sunny skies. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, public radio for the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania. We're Radio Catskill. Farm and Country is next.
How and when one moves on from a pandemic can create a roadmap for future failures.
Once it's over, we all just want to forget it. And because we don't talk about it, those memories fade quite quickly. And that has all sorts of repercussions in terms of our response to the next one. We are not ready. We're never ready.
The long, long, long tale of pandemics past and present on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This afternoon at 4.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
Public radio for the Catskills and northeast Pennsylvania. Radio Catskill.
From river to river, mountain to mountain, keeping you connected.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.